League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
Hello and welcome back to the Sunday Podcast, presented by SportsShoes.com. I'm Ollie Lum.
And I'm Matt Seddon.
Every Sunday we get together with a guest from the distance running world,
giving you an insight into the lives and training of some of the UK's best athletes and coaches.
You can listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and all major podcast streaming services.
You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Sunday Podcast, where we post about our past and present guests, host giveaways, and much more.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope you enjoy the episode.
Welcome back, guys. We got another great guest for you this week. I know I'm a little bit biased, but it is. Look, we got Julian Gota. He's obviously a 13-15 and 27-34 man, but with the National Cross coming up next weekend, we really wanted to chat to him about his famous victory from 1981, where he won in a margin of just under 2 minutes. So fantastic winning time, the largest ever winning time in the English National. Enjoy.
Boy, oh boy, am I excited for you all to listen to this one. Absolutely love recording it. Julian, if you're listening it back, thank you once again, mate. It was a pleasure to record with you. And, you know, as Lumsy introduced, an incredible athlete and done one of the most incredible things in his career, which was win that National Cross. And obviously, by 2 minutes, you know. And obviously, we talk a lot about that race. We talk a lot about the build-up, the race itself, and after the race, and, you know, what he learned after. And, you know, quote-unquote, Julian says it was the easiest race of his life. And that, you know, and I just feel like everyone, no matter how fast or slow, we can almost all relate to that. You know, there's days where we just are in such a sweet spot, such a zone that we feel like we could run all day. And I think if you haven't had that feeling, I promise you, you're due it. And, you know, if you have, you probably can relate. And it's very rare. It only happens once, maybe twice, if you're lucky. But, you know, Julian puts that down to a lot through the mental side of the sport. Physically, he was in obviously very good shape, but he puts that performance a lot down to the mental side and the preparations going in. And, you know, some of it you just can't replicate. You know, he had a bit of luck on the day, you know, in the build up before it was kind of unlucky, but turned out to be lucky. So he delves into all sorts of things, why he thinks that day was so special. He talks about the race itself and after. And then obviously, you know, we talk about the good old days in our sport. So, you know, those oldies out there who love to reminisce, you're going to absolutely love this one. And, you know, for the younger generation, I think you'll relate and you'll love it just as much. So, and you'll be inspired from it. I can assure you that. And one thing you are going to be inspired from is, and kind of learn from is, we talk about Julian's training as well. You know, this is a guy who was a 5K, 10K runner, you know, won the Nationals over 15K, numerous world cross country runner. But his training will surprise you. And it was very, you know, coached by Harry Wilson, Steve Ovett's coach. He would not hang about and his sessions would be very intense. And they weren't always, you know, 10, 15K of volume. So he had different training methods. And it was, you know, fascinating to hear him say about his training and, you know, what training got him in the best possible shape. And a lot of that, I feel like we drifted away from in this country for about 20 or 30 years. And now, funnily enough, it's basically what the Kenyans and the Ethiopians are doing right now. So there's a few similarities in that. But look, as always, enjoy the podcast. National next week. Get out for your Sunday run. Indoors has been cracking. You know, listen out for our review and our preview shows that we're kind of just doing during the week, just to kind of give you guys a little roundup and whatnot and look ahead. But we're definitely going to be doing a British Champs preview as well. So look out for that. There's a lot going on next weekend. Of course, British Indoors and National Cross. We can't give it all to the cross country. So look, enjoy, stay healthy, and we'll catch you next week. Thanks for listening.
First of all, Julian, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you on. You've obviously got some great PBs, 13:15 in the 5K and 27:34 in the 10. But the race we're really interested in is happening again in a couple of weeks' time. National cross country, big victory in 1981, if that's the right year. Won the race by 1 minute 55 seconds, the largest winning margin ever. And with the national win in a couple of weeks, like I just said, we just want to chat about your race, how it was, and then hopefully later we'll get into some predictions for this year as well.
Okay, well, I don't know any of the runners nowadays. I'm not following it so closely, but okay. I can't predict any, except there's only 7.5 miles, is that this year?
They've knocked it down to 12K. It's been like that for a while, to be fair.
I know. I think it's a terrible shame. I think they've watered it down. I think it's it was such a fantastic event, you know, like the Grand National for the horse racing. It was more further than you really wanted to go. And it was an achievement just to complete it in the first place, let alone race it and win it. It was electric. The atmosphere in the old days, just the anticipation of it. It was, can you last the distance? God, all these people are there. It was a trial for the World Cross team. All that's gone. And I think it's a terrible shame. I think the guys who are running now don't realise what they missed. And I don't think that the officials are pleased because it's over quicker. And they've got about 10 races to squeeze in the same afternoon.
Mm.
But the whole point, it used to be such a brilliant day, just three races, the juniors, youths and seniors, men. You know, you don't need all the other races. I know it's difficult to have different venues and so on. But what you end up nowadays with, if you're on last event, like probably the senior men are last, the whole course is churned up already.
Yep.
So it doesn't do the environment or the location any good, and it certainly doesn't do your running any good.
Well, you say
I like mud. I don't mind the mud, but it's too much of a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting you say that. We've spoken a lot on this like podcast previously about, you know, our sport's quite hard to engage fans. Like you say, when it lasts the course of sort of 6 hour days, you know, in a park land, when, like you say, if it's, you know, everyone rocks up for the senior men's race, there's one race going down, maybe a couple before, it really does like build the anticipation, doesn't it, before the race? But
absolutely. Yeah. And plus, of course, what they miss nowadays is the clubs who used to go in a bus all together, you know, the junior youth and the sort of lore of running and the excitement, and that they'd have sweepstakes on, you know, and guess where they might come and who they're going to beat and who might win, and you know, but the whole club would be together traveling down from whatever Gateshead or Exeter or whatever.
Yeah,
but now if you've got kids running at 10 o'clock in the morning, the seniors aren't going to go with them, they all go separate, and likewise the kids aren't going to necessarily stay and watch. It's crazy. I mean, we used to have a guy at our school who, a teacher who started races. He was, you know, my dad did some of the starts, but this other guy came along, and his whole intention was to get the races over as quick as he could. So he'd start the race often before the previous one had finished.
Right, so yeah.
Same sort of thing. Let's get them all done it in one day. And I mean, they have done. I've been at the inter-counties where they've had more than one race going on at once.
Yeah.
It's terrible for the crowd and the runners. They know they're not really being looked at. They're just trying to get them out of the way.
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate that. Another thing I wanted to mention was the distance as well, like 15K. It is, I think, in many ways on that terrain, it is kind of more challenging, like a half marathon. You know, I think your fitness needs to be of a
similar distance. But yeah. I raced to Parliament Hill many times, and in the Southern as well. So that was also the 9 mile, 15K.
Yep.
And nearly always on that particular course, you go up that first hill, you know, you've done about less than half a mile, you've got 8.5 miles still to go, and you're knackered. You know, it's very, very hard. And every hill, but, you know, I mean, I did get fit enough that one year.
Yeah.
And it was easy. And
See,
I was training for all my life, and it actually happened once.
Let's talk about that, because I've obviously read your book, and you mentioned in the book it was the easiest race of your life, and it was the nationals you won by just under 2 minutes, and it was a stacked field as well, wasn't it? You weren't beating, you know, any
other. Everyone was there, I think, except Nick Rowe. Nick wasn't there. No, sorry, what was it?
Dave Bedford was there, was it?
Well, no, he was past it by then. He was 3 years older. You know, Dave didn't run that one.
Dave Moorcroft then?
Yeah, Moorcroft.
Yeah, that's
Moorcroft who I missed meant. The start. That's the story about him.
That's who I meant, yeah.
He came fourth. Yeah?
And
I think that's right.
Yeah, missed the start by 30-odd seconds.
Yeah, so you know, which in fact Bedford had done the previous national, I think, 4 years earlier.
Uh-huh.
So, but they made it difficult for themselves, but yeah. Wouldn't have beaten me.
But he would have done a good job weaving through, you know, 500 or 1,000 odd runners. That would have been some, you know, achievement.
Yeah, because, you know, I did find it easy partly because once you're out in front, you can pick your way right on the edge. I was running like underneath the ropes.
Right.
To keep on the least muddy ground.
Yeah.
But of course, he would have had not much choice, except. Maybe that's the only way he could overtake. Perhaps he was going outside the ropes. Perhaps he was really around. You don't know.
but talk us through the race a little bit, because you I'm sure you can describe it very well. You know, from sort of start to finish.
Yeah, I think about it quite often, and I'm reminded about it quite often because people keep on putting stuff on the website and sending photos and this and that. I mean, really, it's a story about me and Steve Jones, which starts a few weeks earlier because we were both in the RAF.
Mm.
And Steve was very difficult to beat and nearly always beat me into services and nearly always beat me in the RAF champs. Now, the RAF champs are about 3 weeks before the national, and he, sure enough, he did beat me.
Mm.
You know, everyone was tipping him to be the next champion. The thing was, he was Welsh. And he wasn't really supposed to be there, but he joined Bristol to qualify for the English national. You see, because he'd already won the Welsh. The Welsh was on the same day as the area champs, like the Southern.
Okay,
so big rivalry between me and him there, and I'm expecting he's the guy to beat, and. We did the RAF champs, and 2 weeks after that, so 1 week before the national, it was the inter-services down in Portsmouth, and I was running well, and I think I would have beaten Steve, but I would wear sprint spikes with no heel, no real heel, and running through a puddle, I really clonked my heel. It hurt quite a lot on the first lap, and blugger me, I did the same thing on the second lap. It was a different brick, I think, so I knew where that one was. I was trying to avoid it.
Yeah.
Anyway, I had to stop. I stopped for 10 or 15 seconds, and it's probably about half a mile to the finish, and I got going again, and I finished second, Steve won. So this is just a week before national. I think, God, I'm running really well, but let's pray I'm not injured again and miss the national. So I upset all the RAF people that night. They normally go and have they always go and have a celebratory meal, team building, lots of beer, you know, having beaten the Army and the Navy, which I would normally go to. But I said, no, I've got to get off. I can't stand up. I've got to get off my feet and lie, sit and rest and try and get ready for next week. So from that point on, whether I ran or not in the National, it was an absolute touch and go.
Mm.
So you, mentally, as long as you do the race, that's a real plus because you're desperate to race. You don't get nervous, think I'm dreading it or I'm worried about it. You're just desperate to get in the right, you know, to be able to toe the line and not be feeling injured. So I had a couple of days not being able to run at all, and then I tried running. I was based up at Harrogate at the time in the RAF up in Yorkshire. And, of course, it wasn't always easy to train up there anyway, the job I had. But I snatched a few sessions that week and found I could run fast on my toes, but not. I didn't want to risk running a long way on my heels. Mm. And so I sharpened up. I had a sort of very, very different taper towards the race to what I normally would do. Okay. And I did actually try rearing spikes, I think on the, I think probably on the Thursday, maybe on the Wednesday. And I found, you know, quite a relief. I could wear spikes and did 6 times 90 seconds or something fast. Yeah. On the grass at Harrogate. So that was the build up to it. And of course, I went and had a look at the course on the Friday night, and I think it was still frozen then. And I thought, God, I hope rain comes. I'm praying for rain. The softer the ground, the better. If it's frozen, it's going to hurt this heel.
Yeah.
And sure enough, on the day, it was steady rain, but it got wetter and wetter, and I loved it. It was fantastic. So that was the build up to the race, and then. I can remember warming up with a club mate. I mentioned this in the book. He was a guy I used to train with, you know, 10 years earlier when I was training with the Shaftesbury guys with Bob Parker, you know, and Bob used to coach Bedford and all that guys. And he was a great guy to warm up with. You know, I didn't know him very well. You know, I had known him quite well, but we were chatting away and he wasn't, you know, he was just nice and relaxed. It was easy conversation. He wasn't sort of didn't seem nervous himself, and that helped put me at my ease. And it's very important going into a race. You want to be nervous, but you don't want to be too nervous and shaky or worried or thirsty, or, you know, you want to be able to be thinking straight. And it felt that was the start of it, feeling like it was another club run, club championship run. Sort of thing, you know. Yeah. It's just a run, you know, 9 miles, and we'll see how we go. And I can also remember before the start, it was very, very muddy, even then. Yeah, and I was doing some strides in the direction of the start, from start going up the hill, and someone coming across doing a stride 90 degrees to me, right angles, and he's a guy I recognised from school. In English schools one year, a guy called Ben Brown. And so we'd had a very good school team with him and me and several other guys. And we hadn't seen each other about 15 years. And he recognized me and he skidded, he turned and skidded and fell over because he's only wearing plimsolls. You know, it's so muddy. I thought he was mad. Yeah, and yeah. I never found out if he actually finished the race or not. But I think he was running for Randler. Was it Randler? No, Thames. He was running for Thames Down Hounds. Anyway, so we had a chat there, and I had a chat with a few other people. I remember Jimmy Alder was there because he was always very sort of supportive. So it all that helped me just relax and feel at home. And then, of course, the start is always exciting, and you're waiting for the maroon to go, the countdown and that sort of stuff. And, for some reason, I was in the top probably top 10, I suppose, at the top of the hill, maybe higher than that. But I wasn't out of breath. And I thought, yeah, because that's the first obstacle. Get over that first hill and then you can settle down, you know. And within half a mile after that hill, I was pulling away. And I thought, crazy, you don't really want to take the lead yet. The plan was to take the lead with one lap to go after you've gone 6 miles. But I can remember feeling I can't go any slower. There's no need to go any slower. I'm not out of breath. I feel comfortable, a good rhythm. Why can't the guys keep up with me? I mean, it was Dave Clark and I think Terry Colton, I mean, you've probably seen that photo with all his, it's an iconic photo all coming down the hill.
Yeah.
And up the start of the second hill. And Barry Knight, I think, was there. But no, I never saw anybody after that. Never saw anybody. I never heard. It's a strange, strange thing. Because normally you hear puffing and you get splashed and you get elbowed. And there's the odd swear words when someone trips someone up, or, you know, it's all, but yeah. You're aware of everybody around you, and it's not quiet. But my whole race, it was quiet. It was totally quiet. It only, just the odd sort of encouraging comments around the back of the course. And, I had a couple of supporters there. My mate Phil Stamp from Aldershot, I've done a lot of training with. He had seen me take the lead early in a 10,000 meter race at Crystal Palace. That was a trial for the Commonwealth about 3 years earlier. So he'd seen me take the lead when I shouldn't have done in that, or when he thought I shouldn't. But I took the lead in that race because it was raining so hard, and I just was trying to avoid all the splashing, and it was like running on through. Yeah, through the water jump every step. Anyway, I conked out a bit in that race and didn't qualify. I think I came third or something in the race. So Phil, the first lap of the National, he was saying, "Oh, be careful, Julian, you've still got 6 miles to go." He said it quite apprehensive, you know. And the second lap, he said, "Oh, you're still pulling away. You're about a minute ahead already. Mm-hmm. But, take it easy." And then, of course, the third lap, he's over the moon, and he's... you can stop for a cup of tea. There's no one in sight. You know, the whole experience was unlike any race. In a marathon, you might run on your own, but you'd probably have crowds about if it's a big race. But it's quite unusual to run a big race and no real noise at all, except when you come around, I can't even remember it then, being much sort of atmosphere there.
Did you just find yourself in like a pure sort of trance and you were just completely in the zone?
Well, I was in the zone, but I'd raced there often and I'd trained there a lot because I had, I had had 2 or 3 years based at RAF Hendon, which is just down the road. So I used to train on Hampstead Heath, a couple of times a week.
Right.
In those days. So they would all say, "Well, you knew the shortcuts then," but no, I didn't take the shortcuts. But I knew what was coming up. I knew, it helps you pace yourself and prepare for the next little obstacle, a little hill, or when you've got a chance to stretch out. But it gave me the reputation of being good in the mud. In fact, bloody David Coleman, later that summer. Remember Coleman, commentator on BBC? Are you old enough to remember him?
I'd probably recognise his voice if he was a commentator, but...
Yeah, because you're too young, man.
Wouldn't be able to put a face to the name.
he was a very good commentator, but he saw me in the lift. We were up at Gateshead for the Golden 5000.
Right.
And he looked at me in the lift and he said, "What are you doing here, Gota? There's no way you're going to win unless they play out the track up," he said. Yeah. Anyway, I think I came fifth in that, but it was a close race and a very good race. But no, it's not fair to think that that National was muddy all the way. It was a muddy half of that, but it's a very fast return loop. I mean, they do a different loop now. In those days, we used to go up around Kenwood, past Kenwood House, and from there back down to the running track. It was it was downhill most of the way, but very fast, quite sandy, very well drained. There was never any mud coming down that way.
Well, even on when it's muddy at Parley Hill, it's usually, if it's in them woods, it's quite firm because it's really compact dirt. You did do a lot of running in them woods. It is quite firm in there.
Yeah.
Even on a muddy
day. Around the edge, when he used to go out over those, there's several sort of big, big jumps, like ditches.
Right.
Very, quite challenging. They're probably 3-4 foot deep.
Yeah, I think I know the one. They've covered it up now.
They probably have, you see. But that all around there, it was at the bottom of the slope and it did used to get very, very boggy. Sometimes you're up well above your ankles in the mud. amazing. I mean, lots of shoes lost and that sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah,
but so it was a lap of two halves in those days. It was a slog on the way out and fast on the way back. But no, I think if you looked at the team, the England team they selected for the World Cross, which was obviously the first six plus Nick Rose plus I forget a couple of others. Yeah, I think they made me the first eight plus Nick Rose. But all of us, we were all 13:30. 5,000 runners, you know. So that argument that, oh no, 9 miles only gets plodders. You don't want plodders in the England team for the World Cross. It doesn't stack up, you know. You had Dave Clark, Steve Binns, Mike McLeod, Dave Moorcroft, Nick Rose. I mean, it's a heck of a good team, and all fast runners.
Well, suppose your winning time was 44 minutes and something, right? And suppose it is 9 miles, that's sub 5 minute mile then. So,
yeah, you may have been quicker than 44. Have you looked it up? Do you know what the time was?
I'm pretty sure it's 44 something. Yeah.
Well, I'm not, yeah. But either way, it was a fast run. I mean, there was a lot of fast running in it.
Mm.
There was, yeah. But as I say, it was genuinely the easiest race I ever had. And I was never out of breath. Could I have gone faster? Possibly. But, you know, you're in that sort of zone and you're such a good rhythm and timing and balance. You know, could I have gone further? Yes. Yeah. I probably could have done another lap. Probably. Yeah. Which is like Bedford, you know, these years earlier in the Southern. You remember he won the in those days, they had the youths. It was just three races, youths, juniors and seniors. But in those days, they had the juniors first. No, they didn't. They had the youths first and then the juniors. They had the youths first, then the seniors, and then the juniors. And Dave was still a junior. And I had done the youths race, had won that. And then Dave ran the 9 miles senior race as a junior, and he won that by nearly a minute. And then the buzz was going around about 20 minutes later, Dave's going to do the juniors as well. And he won the juniors as well. So, you know, that was 15 miles around there.
Mm.
And you know, he beat some good people. I mean, I think when he started the junior race, I think probably after a mile, he was way down the field. You know, he wasn't up for a fast start, but he just kept going. And he was a very, very, he was a super guy to train with. I mean, I did a lot of training with him. And, you know, very strong, great guy to be trying to keep up with. So, yeah, he helped me a little bit as well.
Yeah. Some fascinating stories there. Like, I just wanted to, why do you think it all came together for you on that one day?
Well, yeah, I tried to give you a little bit of background about the previous sort of 3 weeks, but the previous year, it was the Olympics, and I didn't get selected for the Olympics, so I was very angry about that. I still am, actually, but you know, it was just a problem with the selectors and what they said was necessary to do, and they had the elite squad, and so Foster and McLeod had been selected the year before on their performances from a year ago, and when I was in 1980, when I was running 13:21, I think I was the quickest in the country, but that wasn't quick enough to get. Well, that was, they wouldn't put me in the elite squad on an up to date performance. Oh no, you still got to do the trial. So and in those days, you didn't just have to do the trial and win it, given that there's already two people pre-selected. You had to win it in not even the Olympic qualifying time, but the British qualifying time, which was nearly a minute quicker. Jeez. So to go out to Crystal Palace and run and win a race on your own on a hot, windy afternoon, you set yourself up, you know, and everyone's going to tag, follow you and tag onto you. Or if you don't go far, if you don't try and run fast, you don't get the time anyway.
Yeah.
So as it turned out, I didn't win it, and Nick Rose came by and he actually dropped out because he wasn't feeling too good. He must have dropped out with about three or four laps to go. The guy who won was Jeff Smith. And Jeff Smith won it in a time about 40, maybe 50 seconds outside the British qualifying time, and they selected him. Yeah, so they didn't play ball at all, the selectors. Mm-hmm. You know, they completely misled us. So anyway, that's just an example. So I was angry from the previous year, and what else was going on? I mean, I'd been posted up to Harrogate. On the face of it, it wasn't ideal. It meant weekly commuting, coming back home. But the situation up at Harrogate helped me quite a lot. I had quite a lot of support from the people I was working with. They would encourage me to, you're battling, you're not just battling against to run fast. The weather up there, you had the snow, and it was pretty wild, in comparison with what it was like down south. Mm. So I think I always felt that if I was injury free or pain free, I could run quite quick, and I did manage to keep injury free. But for it to come together all in one day, I mean, that's why I wrote the book and called it the Art of Running Faster, because mm-hmm. it's not all about science. Mm-hmm. You can do your PB sessions on a Wednesday and still be no good when it comes to the race on Saturday. There's no guarantee, in a distance event. I mean, in sprints and cycling and rowing and stuff like that, perhaps if you can do it on one day, you can do it exactly the same the next time. You've got your own lane and it's much more controlled and monitored. But when you're running a race, it's tactics. Other people get in the way. They do things. They put bursts in. Things can go wrong. You can fall. There's so many things. Mm-hmm. But to be mentally right. I mean, I was trying to explain. Really, partly I was angry. Partly I was relaxed mm-hmm. by the guys I was with. I was certainly confident because I knew I was fit. But I was all that week. I was worried that I wasn't going to be fit, able to run. And when you can run, it's such a relief. And yeah, so all that sort of thing came together. But you can't plan. You can't sort of injure yourself on purpose. And it just has to happen. It did happen that time. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because it sounds like really because of the injury, you just had no limits on yourself on the day. Where perhaps if you weren't injured, you'd have been thinking, maybe overthinking your tactics a little bit.
Maybe I'd have trained too hard. I mean, I obviously had an easier week than normal, more rests and more emphasis on speed and cutting out most of the steady running altogether.
Mm. Did you find yourself trying to, because I kind of think all runners kind of hit that sweet spot at some point. Like you said, like you obviously had it at the national, and I think everyone gets it in their own little way at some point. But did you find it hard off the back of that race because you kind of just always wanted to replicate it and you kind of always expected every race to be, as easy as the national?
Yes. It didn't hold me back. It did give me a lot of confidence, and it did give me an insight into a tapering slightly differently.
Mm.
Okay, because I mean, I did the same. I would then try and do the same sort of sessions. You're trying to. I was saying in the book, you're trying. The closer the race gets, you're trying to do sessions which you train for feelings rather than for fitness. It's too late to get any fitter. You just want to train so you get a real buzz and excitement that, you're not injured, you're flying, you can't wait to go fast. Mm. You can't wait for the performance, So it's not just the sessions that give you that feeling. I mean, what goes on at home or at work you can be absolutely knackered, can't you? Just from these outside influences.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I always noticed was I used to race better abroad than in England often. because you'd have to have a day traveling and get there, so you'd have a day off work, you know, and you could. So it was quite good. Or race on Sunday was much better than racing on a Saturday normally. Well, this national was a Saturday, so I'd intentionally taken the Friday off, taken leave from the RAF. Yeah. So yes, I would try and replicate it several times, and I did. I mean, the other sort of perhaps the good race that I did was that 27:34 in Oslo. Mm. And I think that was the following year. I think it was 1982. But I can remember the week before, you know, similar to the national, the week before, I was absolutely knackered before this 10K in Oslo. And I was out for a run, and I dropped out. I just went home. I stopped. Mm. I thought, you know, I didn't feel ill. I felt knackered, just tired mentally and physically. And yeah, I was up in Yorkshire, and you've heard of Dave Slater? You know Dave Slater?
I haven't, unfortunately.
You should. Yeah, he was a big buddy up there. Yeah, I think he came in the top 10 in the World Cross one year. Mm. And anyway, so I'd done a bit of training with him, and we got quite friendly. And so that day I dropped out. I went out on an eating spree. We had tea and cakes in Betty's at Harrogate, and then we went out to the pub in the Yorkshire Moors, and we had beer and a meal. And then there was a Yorkshire tea that afternoon after we'd done a walk. I was stuffing myself, and I thought, I've got no chance in Oslo. I mean, I've virtually given up. You know, I was going to go, but I thought, I've blown it. I'm not going to recover in time. So I had a day or two off and started running. And I think before we flew out on the, probably on the Friday. So I did a session near Heathrow just to get my legs going again, running quite fast, 2 times a mile or something like that. I can remember doing that. Just a blowout. And, you know, I was running okay, but I didn't feel fantastic. But you get to Oslo, and suddenly the air and the ambience and the way where we stay and out by the lake, you know, it was a university accommodation, I think, out there. And the fact that all the other athletes there, I think they always used to do a strawberry party for the athletes the night before or the afternoon before. It wasn't a social trip, you know. So again, great at just making you slightly excited, but very relaxed. And then they were talking about the times they want to do in this 10,000. The pacemaker, yeah, he's going to go through in, I think, 13:45, halfway. And Rono's there, and Lopez, and Salazar. So it was just very exciting. And you know, in a race like that, you don't have to worry about the pace. You just have to stay in there. You know, you're trying to keep on the curb, don't run wide, don't get tripped, and just get carried along. And hopefully the laps tick by. And yeah, I can't remember anything about the first few laps, but we were certainly about 13:42 at halfway. And yeah, you would never have guessed that I would be doing that after the week I'd had scoffing and so yeah, you can always look at it the other way and think, well, if you hadn't been silly and got so overtired, you might have done even better. But there we go.
No, it's so interesting the way you talk about a sport, and obviously you mentioned earlier the book title, kind of The Art of Running. It is just that. Do you think the sport's become a bit too dominated by GPS watches,
absolutely, yeah, it's not that there's only an indicator, and it's not the whole story at all. No, there's no scientific explanation that I know of. You know, you ask me these questions, what made it all come together on the day? I can't tell you anything scientific. It's feelings, it's a combination of anger, you know, motivation, excitement, concentration, you know, all these things which you can't measure. Mm. It comes, you know, from inside you.
Who was coaching you at that time?
Was I coaching? No. No.
No, who no, was it, coaching you, sorry?
Who was coaching me? Right. Yeah, Harry Wilson. Mm-hmm. No, Harry, you see, was coach Steve Ovette and Tony Simmons. He coached lots of good people. I suppose I've been with him for probably 5 years, and he had some good ideas. I mean, lots of my sessions, Bob Parker had been very good as a kid coaching us guys, and but I think I got the feeling that he'd run out of ideas a bit, and not only that, but because Dave Bedford was always in his ear and saying, you know, he's got to do this and he's got to do that, and Bob would just be saying yes, 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 and there's not enough days in the week to fit all that stuff in, so we'd lost that sort of select. It's difficult, isn't it? You've got to be selective, yeah. and at certain times a year, you can't fit everything in, and so I got the feeling that Bob was being too influenced by Dave, really. So in a way, I needed to escape. It was a shame because Bob was absolutely fantastic. But Harry was just a little bit, stand back a bit more and analyse things a bit more and come up with a few ideas. And, of course, he obviously spoke to a lot of people and got a lot of ideas. The thing was, no coach could get me to sprint. That was my problem. You know, they didn't have any ideas about it. They did quite well. But, change of pace and actually being able to sprint, it was a hard thing to, and I never made it that way, which is a shame because everything else is all right.
You say that, but you did, and obviously being coached by Harry Wilson, you did use quite a lot of, speed work, if you like, in your training program. And one thing,
I did loads of speed work.
You talk about massively is the,
See, if I tell you my PB 1500 is 342.0. Mm. Yeah, so what should I have been able to do at 800?
150-ish?
Well, my best one 800 is 155.
Mm. Wow.
So I could almost go that speed for four laps, but I couldn't go any faster for like one lap. The fastest 400 metres was probably 55 something or 50, maybe 54 something.
Wow.
That's for 400.
Right.
But, since I was been coaching, nobody really emphasized the importance of upper body strength and your arms, and I'm sure I didn't use my arms the right way. It helped me drift over the mud quite well, and it helped me keep a good rhythm and keep relaxed over longer distances, but to be really punchy, I needed more strength. I needed to get in the gym more, and but the trouble was we didn't have an off season. It was cross country and track, and when do you get in the gym?
So can you have both? Do you think do you think you can have both, or do you think you would have?
It was just that me. I was too puny. That's all. I was quite strong, but maybe it's more technique. But Harry got us doing some drills. Running drills or sprint drills, but not what I should have done in the gym. I mean, I know Ovette, doing lots of weight training and stuff like that, and obviously Seb Coe did as well. Mm. They seem to have the idea, you've got slow twitch fibers, and that's just the way you are. If I had my time again, I'm sure, in today's with the knowledge they have today, they could have made me a lot faster.
Mm.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is, if you'd have trained, like that in the gym a little bit more, would that have detrimented your performance over the mud, over the country?
Well, it might have done. Yeah. But, but then you'd have been more selective. The time I think I got sort of strongest, it was again after an injury. I'd had my ankle in plaster. I'd torn some ligaments, and we went to Farnham Park, which is a part Farnham Park Hospital, Mm-hmm. It was part of Wexham Park Hospital. And the guy who ran that was Dr. John Williams. Now, he was the guy who started doing all the Achilles operations, for, you know, tendon operations. Mm-hmm. And he was pioneering that. And the deal was he would only do the op if you went to his place at Farnham Park for rehabilitation.
Right.
And so they had a fantastic occupational therapy sort of set up there. And it was full time. And you go from one class to another. There'd be physiotherapy. There'd be working on a treadle, a foot-driven lathe. You know, you'd be cycling on a driving a little jigsaw. You'd be making things, and you'd be doing weights in the gym, but not just with weights. It'd be logs and medicals and stuff like that. You know, but you wouldn't immediately go into that. You'd start off very slow, and you'd gradually be promoted from one class to another as you got better over 5 or 6 weeks. But you come out of there super fit. So I went in, not having walked for 3 weeks with the leg in plaster, and I could hardly walk.
Yeah.
And I was there for 6 weeks, I think. And I didn't do any running there at all. But I did manage to walk, but we started doing things, you know, getting good enough to do circuit training and play volleyball and stuff like that. But when I came out of there, it was only 4 weeks running, and I made the England team for the World Cross. That was the Chepstow. And I just felt so much stronger. And I said at the time, I said, you know, we should really do this. We should have 6 weeks doing this every year. But it's not much fun doing that stuff on your own, is it? And you've got a job to do. This was full time.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I would willingly have done that. If I'd been a sponsored athlete and, lottery funded, and had a regime like that, then definitely I'd have done 6 weeks of that, probably November, December time. And then you'd still be fine for the main cross-country season and the track.
So what you're talking about is...
Sorry, I missed that.
No, I was just saying, so what you're talking about is just like you really benefit from a preparation phase almost. A
proper conditioning thing, yeah. You see, lots of runners talk about conditioning as just going back steady running and let your body gradually recover from the previous summer. I think it's a load of rubbish. You know, you're already conditioned. You run very fast in the summer. Why lose it all? But you do want a different emphasis. You want to get, you know, add to it and do less of it, but don't lose it, but get stronger.
Mm-hmm.
And core strength, upper body strength. It helps you with injury prevention later on as well when you're that strong.
It's super interesting you say that, Julian, because I don't know if you follow like Kipchoge in the way he trains, but he has 4 weeks of basically just circuit training.
Times
a week. So a very similar thing. He'd spend like 2 or 3 hours just circuit training and not actually running. Maybe he runs like once a week. Like, you know, stuff which has come out recently in the past year about the way Kipchoge trains. He'll do that for 4 weeks before he actually starts doing marathon build-up again. So it's interesting. Obviously, you stumbled on this years ago, clearly.
Yeah, well, absolutely. But I didn't. It was difficult. I couldn't do it because I was based at different places in the Air Force. We didn't always have a gym there. And I wasn't the sort of guy to go and do it on my own. I didn't really like going to the gym on my own. I'd willingly go with other people, but then they'd be trying to psych you out doing stupid exercises that would damage you, you know. But you see, it's dead easy to get injured. You're fit enough to hurt yourself. And the coach's feeling was, well, you know, it's only going to make 2 or 3% difference, and it's a bit risky, so be careful.
You know, you're talking about the art of training with people then and how important that was throughout your career.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think it's really important to have a buddy, to a training partner to motivate you to get out. You know, I remember Ovette had Matt Patterson, who was always there. I mean, I had several people, depending on where I was based, you know, club runners. I mentioned Phil Stamp, Dave Slater, James Espier was a club runner I used to do a lot of training with. But yeah, it's great to have is important, I think, to think that you're on a mission with somebody else. You're not just, you know, asking yourself, why am I doing this? You know, and questioning yourself, is this the right thing to do? Or, you know, and you rely on a watch. It's easy to make yourself, to do yourself down when you're up, when you're timing yourself. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not good enough. Or I didn't. The session wasn't as good as I planned. This, that, and the other. You know, and it's nice to have a coach there as well. But often the guy to run with is better still.
Yeah, before we started recording the pod, we were chatting with you about some of your training methods involving kind of other guys and how they dictated the pace. Do you mind telling our listeners about that sort of thing with the fartleks?
Fartlek training. Well, yeah, I think is the. Is a sort of best introduction to sort of speed work. You know, you get such a benefit from fast and slow, repeating fast and slow, not just getting in a rut. And it's very effective, and it can be a lot of fun. I mean, I think I mentioned about when it's a bit like poker. If you get two or three guys who similar sort of standards to do a fartlek session, it's great because it's not measured, it's not timed, there's no real pressure. But you can, with a group like that, you can enhance it a little bit and just have a sort of deal that there's no overtaking. You take it in turns to lead, but the other guys in the group don't know how far you're going. They're not allowed to overtake, so they just got to go the speed you set. And follow and see if they can do it. But as soon as that effort is finished, then one of the other guys takes over. He decides how much rest you get, and then when he puts the next effort in again, how fast and how far. So he might sprint, he might just go for 100 meters, but the other guys have got to react as though he might be going for half a mile, you know. So it's a lot of, you learn a lot about yourself and about what hurts. Yeah, you want to know what hurts the other runners, what they find difficult. And it's, you know, different people have different strengths and weaknesses, but you also learn a lot about yourself, and you think, wow, they struggle with that, and I cope with that quite well. That's the best tactic for me to use. So yeah, it's in a way it's race preparation, but it's also quite lighthearted and fun. It's speed play, that's fartlek, but quite fierce play.
Yeah. It sounds like a very refreshing training session, which I think
yes, it's a lot of fun. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. But
you can do it with people who are not quite the same standard, but you know, you'd probably you'd need long and short cuts, or the better person would have to do an extra effort in between, just to keep it. Because you want to run together. You don't want to be just one in front of the other all the time. Mm-hmm. And you don't want the slower person to feel he's holding you up. Yeah. But often it works the other way. They discover what they can do. And that's what I've been doing coaching. Yeah. I think the skill or the arts of coaching is to help find ways to make the runner or the athlete discover what he actually can do. Because again, all this scientific stuff, training zones, don't go too fast. It holds you back. Mm. And I like the completely other approach, which is, and I've had quite a lot of success with that with just normal people, club athletes, people who they might be 40, 45 minutes 10K runners. And it's because they never trained like that. They're frightened. They think, oh, I'm not sure I can last the distance. I better slow down in case I have to stop. I say, you're allowed to stop. Let's, you know, go faster. Let's see. I don't mind you stopping, but I want you running fast.
Mm. Yeah. I think you said that, and you said the real challenge in our sport is running faster, not further.
Yeah. But it's gone so much the other way, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Make things harder and harder. Yeah,
the attraction these days is all about running further and further and further.
Yeah, and in harder and harder conditions, you know.
Yeah,
marathon, Sable, and all this stuff. Everyone. it leaves me cold, I must admit. I mean, why would you want to? The motivation our day was, God, you know, Ron Clark set a world record. Well, that's what the world record is. The Olympics is all about Olympic records and, you know, trying to go faster on measured distances, not further, just, you know, even cross country, the times don't mean anything. But the positions and the distances between runners makes it, that does matter.
It's
got dumbed down, and it's got too scientific, and too, you know, people where the, you know, they got their bloody headphones in, you know, not this. They do, and I can't believe it. I mean, can you imagine? Do you run with headphones in?
No, I'm anti headphones.
I mean, purists.
Yeah, I quite like the way in this day and age, like, it's the kind of one time I can just actually switch off and enjoy just being, you know, out for a run.
There's so much to hear and, you know, and listen to, and, you know, whether it's the birds or, the, you know, but you want to know if there's a car behind you when you're running across the road.
Don't encourage people too much, Julian, because the podcast is meant for people when they're on a Sunday long run to listen to the podcast.
You know? Yeah, right. So, put some fast music on, that might make them speed up a bit.
It's so interesting what you said about just learning about yourself doing those sorts of sessions rather than being prescribed what to do. You're actually just learning about yourself as an athlete, and I think that's so important and so overlooked.
Yeah, well, you know, it would be prescribed to do a fartlek, but how you do it and the benefits you get from it, it does depend how you do it, doesn't it?
And talk a little bit about double days, because I know you're a big believer in double daying.
Oh, definitely. You know, I did find that, and I was probably doing about 15 miles a week. I didn't have a proper schedule. I just trained twice a week at school. My dad was a teacher there, and he would sort of take us for a run or set a session sometimes. He did some quite good interval sessions, power lap type sessions. But, you know, I found I wasn't improving. And they said, oh, you've got to join, get a proper coach, go and see Bob Parker. And Bob obviously was coaching Dave Bedford at the time. And he got me down for, I think that it bumped me up from those 15, maybe maximum 20 miles in a week to about 45. Now, in the space of, that was in the probably about April, May time before the summer season. In that summer, I must have knocked 25 seconds, I think, off my mile time. You know, just by doing one mile. Yeah, you know, it's pretty good. You know, not that it was a very fast time beforehand, because I was a plodder. I mean, people I could beat across country, I couldn't beat him on the track before that season, and afterwards I got down from whatever. I was doing about 4:50 for a mile down to, you know, 4:25. That'd be about right, wouldn't it? Yeah. 1500s were just coming in, so I was doing about just 4:06, something like that, for 1500.
Yeah.
Anyway, so then Bob writes out a schedule, as he did for all his athletes, and Bedford, he got Dave's 3 years older than me. Dave, yeah, I've got him down for doing, you're probably over 100 mile a week. So Dave would have been sort of 19, 20 years old at that stage. And Julian, yeah, you can do, I've got you 19, down for about...
You're about 19, 20 years old doing over 100 mile a week?
Yeah.
Wow.
That was Dave. Yeah.
I think we've lost touch in that as well. You know, how hard you guys were training back in the day.
That's right.
I mean, we went soft for a period, but we're out the other side now, I think.
Yeah. Well, you know, and so I took it as a bit of an insult that he's only got me down for 50. Anyway, so we started off, and so I'd bumped it up from that 40 odd mile a week in the summer, and I was doing 50, 55, 60. And I did start training twice a day. You see, you hit the sweet spot. Well, I didn't have any injuries at that time, and it was exciting. And especially like the first race I did, it was one of those road relays, Belgrave road relays. And the guys who'd beaten me in the English schools 1500. Can you imagine in those days to get to the final of the English schools 1500, there were 12 heats. So it was just the winner, one person per heat, plus I think two fastest losers. It was really difficult to make the final. Mm. Yeah, this, I'm not just saying about the standard, but the numbers of people doing it, the depth of runners. This is what you're up against. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I didn't make the final, but 2 months later in the road relays, I was hammering everyone. You know, it was Ian Whittle, Terry Colton, Bernie Ford, all people who had probably beaten me, Barry Smith. And so it made a huge difference, just getting the miles in. Mm. You know, so I was doing 17, 75 mile a week, and then that's well, I was 17. I think I said to you before, when I was at uni, so that's a few years later, we had a house full of athletes, you know, three or four other guys who, and I could not persuade them. They wanted to do 70 mile a week, same as me, but they wanted to do it in one run a day. Mm-hmm. And I think that the you do end up then getting stale and overtired and plodding, because 10 miles is a long way to run in one go all the time. And I said, no, you're much better doing splitting it. Do two fives a day, or a three and a seven, or sometimes a five and a seven. Run twice a day, and do 12 miles in one day, and then just five or six another day. Mm. But you know, the second run of the day, let's say the other run of the day, is probably the first run of the day, is a recovery run from the day before, or a preparation run for the main session later in the day. But you do need some runs where you're feeling easy, and when you finish the run, you think, oh, I could have carried on. I'm looking forward to the next run. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be feeling absolutely knackered mm-hmm. after every run throughout the week, and then, oh God, you get stale, and you lose the speed, you lose the mental excitement. It's a bore, isn't it? Mm. But physiologically, if you're doing 12 runs a week instead of just six or seven, you've got more sort of pegs to hang different sessions on, and it's important. Some of the sessions should be easy. Yeah. Well, if you can't, you know, I get people now, they say, well, it's all right, I'm going to do 10 miles, but it's only easy. It doesn't do them any good at all.
Yeah.
One long run a week is fine. But to practice plodding,
yeah,
it's no good. You want to get the running out of the way quick. You want to be feeling fast.
That really jumped out at me when you spoke about sort of injury prevention. And yeah, like you say, trying to avoid becoming a plodder, was the fact that you know, the shorter runs you do and the more frequent you do, the chances are your speed variation is going to be so much more. You may do a few more sessions that week because you're just a little bit fresher anyway. You may end, the evening runs ends up being a little bit quicker because you're a bit fresher. And so you're never running at that same plodding consistent pace you know, too much in one go. And at the end of the day, that's how you get injured, right?
Yeah, exactly. A change is as good as a rest. You know, different range of movement, different landing. You're often more cushioned and lighter on your feet when you're going fast. Yeah, it's like riding a bike. Great. Your balance is better when you're going fast rather than when you're slow. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're going slow, you think, well, no need to worry about it. I can plod and heavy landing. Just, you know, you want quick feet, zippy. You want to feel zippy.
Yeah.
Anyway, I should be coaching you guys.
Hey, yeah, you probably should. We haven't won a national cross yet, so. And we'd both love to.
You're racing it yourself, Ian.
I'll try, man. I've been a little bit injured and a little bit ill, but you know, you've kind of inspired me that.
I was going to say the same.
You can still win a national cross when you're injured or coming off an injury. So. But look, let's just finish with, you know, a little bit of advice for people who are doing, you know, Parley Hill. It's back at Parley Hill. It's had 2 years out of COVID or a year out. Give people a little bit of advice for 12K Nationals.
Well, how to run it?
Well, just how to run it. Yeah, how to get the best out of themselves, you know.
Well, warm up as usual. you've got to have a fast start because it is hard overtaking. You've got to be prepared for a fast start, but get a good position at the top of that first hill. I mean, it's so many races, whether even on the track. You know, when I was running fast 10,000s, often the best thing to do was to say, just worry about the first mile. Get in a rhythm, get in position, be feeling in control, and then you can do the race. I mean, if you're doing a marathon, I would say get the first 20 miles out of the way and then start racing. You know what I mean? Yeah. You don't want to race, but in cross country, far more than in a road race or a track race, you have to get a fast start because there's so many runners. And so you've got to, how many weeks before national now? You've got time to do a little bit of speed work.
Yeah. yeah, to get to the top of that hill.
Yeah. But so, how else? What else would I say? I mean, try not to plod. Try and be light feet. I mean, whatever shoes you wear, you can put long spikes in if it's really muddy. Mm. Give you a better grip. Mm-hmm. I don't know. That's the thing.
Why did you wear sprint spikes then? Because you mentioned it earlier.
Yeah, not little studs. I don't mean sprint length spikes. But
I just mean the shoes. What was your thinking?
Right, the shoes. I don't think in those days that they had like wedge-heeled spikes.
Hmm.
Right. If they did, the wedge heel would have studs in. And, I don't mean like metal studs, but it would be like like the bottom of an off-road training shoe. You know, it'd have some grip, but it'd have weight. Mm.
Yeah,
and I used to use those Adidas sprint spikes, which we had a very slightly cushioned heel.
Yeah,
but they were light and they weren't absorbent. So you wouldn't get, and they wouldn't pick up all the mud.
Yeah.
So I forget the material. It wasn't kangaroo skin. It was it was man-made poly fiber of some sort. Mm. But they stayed light and they didn't pick up the mud. Now you didn't need a grip on the heel. You needed longish spikes depending on how muddy it was at the front. And yeah. So running cross country, soft ground, you don't. It was very comfy. Mm. You know, you're running on the grass.
Yeah, I did my socks. Yeah.
Yeah. The only trouble was if you have to go, you know, half a mile up a road or something.
Yeah.
Or you go on gravel or. Mm. So occasionally it was a bit crunchy, but yeah. Around Parham Hill was fantastic. I wore actually that particular national. I think I wore javelin spikes. I mean, I think they were 18 mils. They were long, long spikes. Oh, the actual
pins, yeah.
18 mils.
They were really long spikes. And I didn't fall over. You know, I had great grip. It was
had fantastic. To pick your feet up then.
Yeah, I think I'm right in saying 18 mil. Whatever the longest ones were, you could get. Because normally you get 12s and 12 mils, I seem to remember, and 15s weren't too bad. But these were ultra long.
Wow. Yeah. Well, there you go. That's the advice. If anyone can find some 18 mils, they'll be they'll be getting them in.
They may not make them anymore. This is just old day.
You're probably right with the javelin for field events. They probably do have them. So
I'm not convinced. I think it's a health and safety issue. 18 mils sound ridiculous.
Well, there's a market now for them. But anyway, Julian, it's been great to talk to you, and just thank you for sharing your story. It's been really interesting.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for having me. Okay.
Thank you, Julian.
Bye-bye. Okay, cheers.
Lee. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ Mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.